Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. The United Nations interim force in Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, is demanding a full explanation as to why two Israeli tanks drove through the gates of one of their compounds in southern Lebanon early this morning. At around 4:30 local time, the UN says that two Israeli tanks forcibly entered the base in the Ramia area, which is about halfway along the border. They stayed for around 45 minutes, they said, before leaving. In a later statement, the Israeli Defence Force said that the tanks were attempting to assist injured Israeli soldiers in the area and inadvertently destroyed the gates of the compound. Well, relations between the UNIFIL and the Israeli government have been strained in recent days. And today, in a speech posted online, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu demanded the UN peacekeepers left southern Lebanon.
We are not fighting the Lebanese people. We are fighting the Iranian terror branch, Hezbollah, which took over Lebanon. I want to address the UN Secretary General directly from here. It is time that you take UNIFIL out of Hezbollah strongholds and out of the combat areas. The IDF repeatedly asked for that and was refused repeatedly, with the aim of providing Hezbollah terrorists with a human protective shield.
Benjamin Netanyahu speaking earlier today. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from our correspondent live in Beirut. But first, let's hear from the UNIFIL spokesman, Andrea Tenenti. He gave his reaction to today's events to the BBC's Ugo Bechega just a short time ago.
Well, it's very concerning what happened today, what happened the day before, what happened the last several days. Several attacks against our peacekeepers. Today we had Israeli forces entering inside one of our positions in the middle of the night. They stayed there for 45 minutes, damaging the entrance and leaving shortly after. And then there was explosion immediately 1 hour later outside the base with smoke, and our Ghanaian peacekeepers, 15, although they were wearing masks, they had irritation of the skin, gastrointestinal problems, and they are now recovering. So the situation is serious. Has been serious, as I said, since IDF decided and informed us they would enter inside Lebanese territory for these targeted incursions. And after that, they asked the mission to leave some of the positions close to the blue line. And there was an unanimous decision with all the troop contributing countries to stay, because that's our role.
It's the fourth time in as many days that you come under attack, come under Israeli attack. Do you think this is deliberate?
Well, we are seeing that the first one was injuring two peacekeepers inside our headquarters. So how that's a deliberate attack, attacking and hitting like the illumination of our base, the cameras, having a drone going inside the base close to our bunkers. I don't know. These are all incidents that they're making us think, why are they doing it? We are here, as I said, to trying to bring back some kind of stability to the south of Lebanon. And it's also their obligation to protect peacekeepers. So this is a violation of 1701, but also a serious violation of international humanitarian law.
And if this is deliberate, what are they trying to achieve?
Well, this is a question we should ask them, because we have been in touch with the IDF, we have been in touch with the Lebanese, with the Israeli authorities to understand why that happened, and the idea that at the time there were Hezbollah militias close to the base, but at the time there was not exchanges of fire, and we were inside our base, inside the headquarters, which is a pretty visible position, pretty large position. So very concerning. And it's also concerning because we don't have the same ability to monitor the head of operations. We have 29 positions close to the blue line, and most of our peacekeepers at the moment are over 10,000 peacekeepers from 50 countries. They are inside the bases. We can still have some limited monitoring capabilities. We also have radars to monitor the ongoing shelling and exchanges of fire, but very difficult. And the most difficult part is that we cannot, at the moment, assist the local populations, or work together in coordination with humanitarian agencies, UN agencies, to bring assistance to thousands of people that are still stuck in villages without basic needs.
The Israeli Prime Minister is saying that you should leave those bases along the border.
Well, I know this was something that he told the Secretary General. We will see what the Secretary General of the United Nations will respond.
Are you going to leave?
Let's see what the Secretary General will say, but at the moment we decided just the other day that we are staying. There was an unanimous decision. We are here at the request of the Security Council. We cannot let one member state decide the fate of an international organization, of a peacekeeping mission that is there because of the will of the international community.
UNIFIL spokesman Andrea Tanenti there speaking to the BBC's Ugo Bachega a short time ago. Well, we have approached the Israeli government, including the Israeli permanent representative to the United Nations, to get an interview on their view of what happened today. But nobody was available to speak to us. But we can go live now to the BBC's Anna Foster, who joins us from Beirut. And Anna, I mean, there's two very different stories being told about this incident, and it kind of underlines a deterioration, really, in relations between UNIFIL and the Israelis in the past few days. How serious could all this be?
Well, I think it's interesting when you listen, as you did in the news bulletin there, to the statement that Benjamin Netanyahu made, where he was directly addressing the Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres. Now, their relationship has really deteriorated. It was never the warmest, but just a couple of weeks ago, Israel declared him persona non grata. Benjamin Netanyahu believes that he is not supportive of the Israeli cause. And it was interesting that he has spoken to him and said, remove your peacekeepers. But actually, as you heard Andrea Tanenti from UNIFIL say there, they are there because of the UN Security Council, not because of the Secretary General. They are there under UN Resolution 1701, which was renewed after the war in 2006. Both Israel and Lebanon signed up to that. So those peacekeepers are there. They are doing an agreed job. And now Israel is changing the parameters. Now it's decided to stage this ground invasion of Lebanon. Their troops have gone across the border and they're now asking UNIFIL to leave. I think politically, there's a very good chance that they won't do that. Perhaps the UN Security Council will discuss it. But it sets, I think, they would consider a dangerous precedent. And logistically as well, it makes it very difficult for them to do their jobs. If they withdraw from their bases, where would they go?
Anna, we're going to hear more about the fighting in southern Lebanon in a moment. But there's been quite a significant drone strike in northern Israel today as well, around 60 people having been injured there. Can you tell us any more?
That's right. I mean, Hezbollah has repeatedly been firing missiles, rockets, all sorts of different projectiles across the border to northern Israel. But it also sometimes launches these drone attacks as well. And what we seem to be seeing in an area that's between Haifa and Tel Aviv, it appears that a Hezbollah drone has actually got through Israel's defensive systems and managed to hit a military training camp. Now, it's still sort of very early. We're still hearing details about that. But it looks like, as you say, around 60 or so people have been injured, a small number of them critically. People have been taken to hospital. It will be, of course, enormously concerning that that drone managed to get through. Hezbollah will consider this to be a success. You know, they said that they were doing this in response to the Israeli ground operation that was launched.
Okay.
Israel will be concerned that it wasn't picked up by the defence system. And it just raises tensions even higher.
OK, thank you very much indeed for joining us live from Beirut, the BBC's Anna Foster there. Well, there have been reports, as I say, from both sides of close contact fighting in southern Lebanon between Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters. The IDF has also taken international journalists across the border into Lebanon for the first time. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson was among those embedded with Israeli troops. Her access was therefore restricted. Her report was checked by the IDF for restricted military information, but its editorial content was not restricted.
We drove along the old ceasefire line dividing Israel from Lebanon, moving fast under the threat of Hezbollah attack, the rest of the army convoy lost in clouds of yellow dust behind us.
We just crossed into southern Lebanon with the Israeli army. It's still a very unpredictable situation here. Regular threats from Hezbollah forces.
Israel's army broke through this border less than 2 weeks ago. Now they're taking us in to show us one of the villages under their control, a couple of miles into Lebanese territory. The area, still not clear of Hezbollah fighters.
We are literally in an area which still haven't been neutralized. Right? It's a war zone with all the implications you can hear in the background.
The Divisional Chief of Staff, Colonel Roy Russo, showed us a storage room he said was used as a base by Hezbollah.
And here they're morphing from civilians into combatants operators. So you have AK-47s, you have personal gear, you have anti-tank missiles, you saw one of the launches over there, and the unit becomes an effective combat unit here. All this gear is designed to maneuver into the Israeli side and conduct operation on the Israeli side. This is not defensive, but this is called counterattack.
Israel says these are limited, targeted raids. Geographically, perhaps, militarily, less so. Many of the buildings we saw had been demolished, reduced to rubble. Two tanks sit in a clearing nearby.
They want to do the 7th of October here in the northern border.
The army told us they'd found dozens of booby-trapped houses here and demolished them. We only have their account of what happened here and were restricted in where we could go. They also showed us the weapons they said they'd found here, including sophisticated anti-tank missiles, shoulder-launched rockets and night scopes. Some of them brand new, still packed into boxes. Preparations for a cross-border attack into Israel, the army said.
This is, I can say, two times more or three times more than Gaza in the weapons that this village contains.
This, Colonel Malka told me, is why the army was here, not for occupation.
We don't want to hold these places. We want to clean them out from all the weapons and the ammunition. That's what we want. After that, we are expecting that the people will come back and understand that peace is better to them and terrorists controlling on them is a bad thing. But I leave it to the diplomat to solve. This is my guys. This is my guys fighting on the Kasbah.
There's been bursts of small arms fire and artillery very close by. He says his forces are fighting Hezbollah 500 metres away.
And that report from our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson there with Israeli troops in southern Lebanon. Coming up later in the programme, the slow recovery process in the aftermath of Hurricane Milton that battered the Florida coast last week.
People whose homes suffered damage from Helene, they're slow to recover because of Milton. And it's not just Florida, right? We know that other homes in North Carolina, in Georgia, also need resources. And so these resources are being stretched thin.
More on that story to come, and a reminder of our headlines this hour. As we've been hearing, a spokesman for the UN mission in southern Lebanon has said repeated incidents involving the Israeli military that have injured its peacekeepers have raised questions about Israel's motives. And Hezbollah says it sent a barrage of attack drones into northern Israel. Reports say dozens of people have been injured there. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, there was a moment of history in marathon running today as Kenyan runner Ruth Chepnedich smashed the women's world record by almost 2 minutes, winning the Chicago Marathon with a time of 2 hours, 9 minutes and 57 seconds. This is the moment she crossed the finish line. Unbelievable indeed. Well, very shortly after that moment, we managed to get through to Ruth on the phone. I asked her how it felt to be the new world record holder.
I feel so good. I'm happy because of the win and because of the world record.
Well, quite. I mean, did you know as you went round the course that you were on course for a very fast time?
I had prepared well and I was seeing projected time in the car. And I knew this is a world record. I just focused with my perseverance and I made it.
So, I mean, you make it sound very easy, but this is an extraordinary achievement. You've taken around 2 minutes off the world record for the women's marathon. And you say you are focused. What does that mean? What's going through your mind as you're running a race like that?
My mind was thinking about the world record.
Really? And, the whole way around? Okay. So that was in your mind right from the beginning?
Yeah, since my preparation, the world record was in my mind, yeah.
And, I mean, it sounds like a stupid question, but why? Why did you want this record so much?
Since 2022, and I missed it with a 14 second. I didn't give up. I just go back to Kenya and work on my on my areas where I was weak.
Can you tell us a little bit about what those areas might be? I mean, what did you have to work on?
In my preparation, I was working much on tempo runs and long runs.
Endurance.
Endurance to be more faster. Yeah.
Just talk us through, when you run a marathon, which is the most difficult bit? I mean, I sort of presume it's the end when you're so tired, but actually, is it somewhere in the middle where you've still got so many miles still to run?
Around 25K, 34K, and towards the finishing line.
What was going through your mind then?
What was in my mind was to push myself hard, and I did it.
You certainly did. I mean, what do you think this will mean for the folks back home in Kenya?
It means a lot to me and a lot to my country, Kenya, that the world record has go back to Kenya again. And I think it has motivated a lot of people. And nothing is impossible in life.
Ruth Chepnedich there, the world's fastest female marathon runner. Well, I've also been speaking to Rose Harvey, who you may remember was the British runner who completed the marathon at the Olympics in Paris this year with a broken leg. She gave me her reaction to Ruth's achievement today.
Ruth's victory at Chicago is just nothing short of extraordinary. I mean, to beat the world record by more than 2 minutes is incredible in itself, but I think just going under that sub 2:10 mark is such a huge landmark in women's marathon running. It really just pushes the boundaries of what we ever thought was possible. And I really do think it's kind of a culmination of everything we've seen over the last few years. It's incredible to think that Paula Radcliffe's record stood for 16 years. And I feel like since Bridget Koskaya broke it in 2019, it's kind of broken down that barrier. And the times have just been coming down each year. You know, last year we saw the record fall to 211, which everyone thought was crazy. And now we've done it again and it's gone down to 209. It really is. It's amazing.
And do we know why this is happening after so many years, as you say, 16 years of Paula Radcliffe? Is it something to do with the training or preparation? What's behind it?
I think it's a whole host of factors. It probably is a bit of a mental barrier in that once someone does it, it's that effect. Once someone does it, people think it's possible. And once Paula Radcliffe's record fell, everyone saw that those kind of times were achievable and were going after them. I think also the shoe technology does help. We can't shy away from that. It's not just the performance on race day, but it's the ability to train more and recover more. The shoes, the technology in the shoes play a huge part in saving your legs when you're training.
Yeah, yeah. What's changed with the footwear then?
The carbon plates is a really big factor. Most of the, I mean, all of the elites now run in carbon plated shoes, and the foam is also has changed massively. When we look back to, you know, when Paula was running, the shoes were so minimalist. They had no foam in them at all. And I just think, looking back, that their legs must have been absolutely destroyed by the end of long runs. But now we've got so much cushioning in the shoes, it absorbs so much shock and it does allow you to recover so much quicker. And that means everyone can train harder for longer and with less injuries.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. When we spoke to Ruth, she said she was just so focused in the race today. She just said she was just had the world record in her mind the whole way round. But I mean, this is one of the big intrigues of marathon running, isn't it? It's the kind of mental fortitude you need to have to make it through a race, you know, never mind doing it in a fast way. What is going through the mind of a marathon runner?
I think you're right. It's such a mental game and having that focus is absolutely key. I actually ran Chicago last year, so I can kind of picture what was going round ahead. I mean, the crowds are amazing at Chicago. Everyone comes out. The US loves a good marathon. So the atmosphere will have been amazing, but just staying focused and staying calm is so crucial because obviously you get tired in the marathon. She was running incredibly fast, but she will have been feeling that fatigue in the latter stages. And it is just about keeping your legs turning over, even when things start to tire, and just keeping the pace consistent. I mean, her splits are incredible. She was running, her average pace, just to put it in perspective, was 4:57 per mile.
Oof,
which
wow.
is, if anyone tries to do that on the treadmill, good luck.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? You mentioned how fast her splits were. We found out that only 9 men ran faster than Ruth in this race today, which is also extraordinary.
It is. And I think it's this performance really just speaks volumes about how far women's marathon running has come. Year after year, we see women closing the gap to men's marathon times. And I mean, if you look at ultra marathons, actually, there are even cases where women quite regularly outperform men. So women do have this incredible ability in endurance running specifically. And I think the times are a lot closer, but this is the closest we've ever seen them come. And I think it is amazing. It's a real proof of the limits of what female athletes can achieve are still being rewritten.
Rose Harvey there, British marathon runner, reflecting on the achievement of Kenyan Ruth Chepnedich, who has run the fastest ever marathon time by a woman, finishing in under 2 hours and 10 minutes in Chicago today. And congratulations to her.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. After a year of fighting and more than 42,000 deaths, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, Israel's offensive in Gaza continues. A new strategy appears to be underway in northern Gaza. The Israeli military is ordering all Palestinians to leave the area immediately. One of those determined to stay is George Antone. He's a Catholic charity worker who's taken shelter in a church in Gaza City. He's been speaking to my colleague Edward Sturton.
We're following the news and we were very scary actually for what will happen, especially of what we are hearing that's happening now in the north of Gaza in Jabalia, Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia. You know, we hear the news about killing, shelling, bombardment. We're like imagining if, you know, the IDF will invade the area where we are, what will happen to us, to our children, to our wives, to our mothers, our sisters, what will happen to the disabled children and the people that's sheltering in the church here.
How is your position as regard food goes?
We're trying now to get from the market whatever we can, because we heard from the people on the street there is no any more assistance coming to Gaza. What we can do, we can try to buy food from the market as much as we can, knowing that the prices are very high and we cannot afford buy everything, you know, especially that we do not have a cash flow. Most of us do not have any source of income since the first of the war.
You mentioned the reports of what's happening in Jabalia, and among the reports are that the Israelis are ordering people to evacuate the area. If they do the same way you are, will you leave?
No, I'm not leaving the church. No, not at all. Whatever it will cost me, I will not leave the church. I have nowhere to go. You know, this is my church. This is my land. This is my city. This is where I belong. You know, I'm out of this conflict. I'm not Hamas. You know, I'm not IDF. I'm a normal Palestinian citizen. We should not pay for that. You know, we should not pay. Me and my family and the other people here, we should not pay. I mean, we don't understand why all this happening now. You know, we're Palestinians, we're Gazan citizens. This is where we belong.
And on perhaps a more cheerful note, I understand that you've been receiving regular messages from the Pope. Has that made a difference?
Yes, of course. This is something that we can rely on, asking for protection as well. But even though we understand when the place here is a battlefield, there will be no rules, you know, and there will be no respect for any place. So, we think a lot of what will happen. And we have so many bad scenarios in our minds and we're trying to get ready for that. But this is what we have.
George Antone there, a charity worker in Gaza, speaking to the BBC's Ed Sturton. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. More than 3 million homes and businesses are still without power in Florida following the two hurricanes that battered the southeastern United States over the past couple of weeks. Today, President Biden is in Florida to see the damage wrought by Hurricanes Helene and Milton for himself. He promised $500 million in funding to restore power lines. And speaking at St. Pete Beach earlier, he called for national unity.
And it's in moments like this we come together to take care of each other, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans. Americans who need help, and Americans who help you if you were in the same situation. We are one United States, one United States.
Well, earlier I spoke to Colleen Wright. She's a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times in St. Petersburg. And first, she told us more about those power issues.
It's a big impact. We've been out right since the hurricane arrived Wednesday night. My power was actually restored about 3 hours ago, and I'm so grateful because it was getting a little old dealing without power, without air conditioning. It's still very hot here in Florida. And there, we've been seeing, I think the biggest issue is very long lines for gas. For gasoline, people have transformer, people have generators, gas power generators that run their maybe a window unit or a refrigerator to keep their food cold. And that's running out because we're on like the fourth day without power. Mm. So I've seen like electrical trucks, even from as far away as other states, you know, go around. We've seen linemen out and about. I believe it's just a numbers game. There's just so many people out there without power. But slowly but surely, it seems like power is coming back online.
And Colleen, I mean, this area of the country, people are pretty resilient. They're used to storms. But this combination of two hurricanes back to back and the ferocity of them seems particularly tough this time.
Yeah, very difficult. And people are tired. You know, we live in Florida. You know, I'm almost a third generation Floridian myself. I grew up in Miami. We've had back to back hurricanes growing up. But even here, I think that the biggest challenge here was people were very afraid of the debris piles in front of people's homes. During Hurricane Helene, many thousands of homes were flooded. And so people started taking out waterlogged furniture, drywall, just debris, a lot of vegetation, and piling it up in front of their homes. And there was a big fear that Hurricane Milton would blow all that debris everywhere and there would be millions of projectiles. But since we saw so much rain and no storm surge, but a lot of rain, it seems like some of those piles stayed intact. So that was, I think, the scariest part of it going into it was we thought that there would be projectiles everywhere, but that ended up not being the case. And this was mostly more of a wind event and then a lot of rain. I think we saw like 18 inches overnight. So there were some homes still did get damaged, but it wasn't like Helene with the storm surge and the flooding we saw then. It's exhausting to get power. But, you know, I lost power during Helene too, and to have it and then lose it again and have it and make arrangements, and everybody's situation is different, but it is exhausting.
And as you say, so many homes have been damaged by one or other or both of the hurricanes. Clearly, lots of people will have insurance, but not all. And it's going to take so much time to get those repairs done, I guess.
People whose homes suffered damage from Helene, they're slow to recover because of Milton. And it's not just Florida, right? We know that other homes in North Carolina, in Georgia, also need resources. And so these resources are being stretched thin. And, you know, people aren't robots. They can't work all day long. So it takes a lot of patience, but it's difficult when you might not have power, when you might not have connectivity. You know, work still goes on. Bills need to be paid. And as far as insurance, that's always a struggle. Some people can't afford their home insurance. Florida has a big home insurance problem. I'm seeing a lot of GoFundMes for people who have lost the contents in their home. A photojournalist at the Tampa Bay Times, his home with his wife and kids, you know, they lost everything. We have a GoFundMe for them. So you're seeing a lot of that.
And I guess, you know, for the insurance companies, this could be a major problem with so many people needing help.
Absolutely. It's definitely going to be a major headache. FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. You might not even pay twice for the same kind of like materials, I believe, or repairs. If your home's been flooded, you know, maybe during Helene and one time before, you might run into a problem there. So it's difficult.
And Colleen, of course, all of this is happening with less than a month to go before the elections. And there have been criticisms coming in nationally that the handling of this crisis has become a political issue. Is that something that's been felt locally?
I've seen a few groups, especially here in Florida. I believe that the time to register to vote for the November election was as preparations were ramping up for Helene, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did not extend the deadline. So I believe some groups might have sued over that. But I'll tell you, as a lifelong Floridian, the election, I feel like to some people feels very far away. The immediate problem is, do I have power? Do we have gas? The election, even though it seems so close, I would not say it's very top of mind right now.
And was the presence of the president today any comfort to local people?
You know, I'm not working today, but I've read just from my colleagues reporting that some people were protesting the president. Some people were waving and welcoming him. You know, this just happens all the time. This is a very mixed state. We've got a lot of diversity of thought and opinion here. So I'm sure to some people it's comforting. I'm sure to others maybe it isn't. But again, I think people are just really focusing on like what's best for their families and how their homes are faring right now.
Colleen Wright there. She's a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times in St. Petersburg. Now, there's always been a mystery surrounding exactly where the 15th century explorer Christopher Columbus came from. Was he really from Portugal or Italy? Could he actually have been Hungarian? Well, now, new research on the remains of the man whose expedition across the Atlantic in 1492 changed the course of world history suggests he was probably from Valencia in Spain, and he was probably Jewish. And that is a highly significant piece of information, given the horrific persecution suffered by Jews and others considered heretics during the Spanish Inquisition started under the Catholic monarch Ferdinand II. For more on all this, I've been speaking to Devon E. Nahr, who's professor in Sephardic studies at the University of Washington in Seattle.
So what the Spanish Inquisition did was it targeted not Jews as Jews and not Muslims as Muslims, but rather initially and specifically those who were of Jewish or Muslim origin, but who had converted to Catholicism. And there was a perception that they had continued to practice Judaism on the one hand or Islam on the other hand in secret. The Inquisition used a variety of different means to try to coerce confessions. It used all of the different medieval style tools that we might think about, the ultimate one being the auto da fé, which was burning at the stake.
Christopher Columbus then, obviously he was a wonderful navigator to make it all the way across the Atlantic, but he was also operating and navigating this political landscape where he had real reason to fear for his own safety. How do you think he managed to navigate this period?
I think it's something that continues to be up for discussion among historians and scholars. The claim that Columbus was of Spanish Jewish origin or converso origin, of converted Jewish origin, has been around for over 100 years. One of the first claims is by Spanish scholars themselves. And the claim emerges in the wake of the Spanish-American War, in which Spain loses in 1898. This was a kind of a political endeavor to change the face and the image of Spain in the wake of its imperial losses. So like, that's one important piece to have in mind. And a second important piece to have in mind is the claim around Columbus in a specifically Jewish context. But already in the 1890s, on the eve of the 1892 400th anniversary of 1492, there are scholars like Meyer Kaeserling, who was an important Jewish writer, who focuses on if Columbus was not Jewish, certainly there were Jewish people on his ships and among his crew. And this becomes an important endeavor to try to demonstrate that Jews have been part of American society since the beginning of European colonization. And it becomes a way to try to combat anti-Semitism in the United States at the time. Jews have been part of the European colonial project since the beginning, so do not discriminate against Jews. We are part of the West. We are part of white society.
And you mentioned this rich history of Jewish culture in Spain. Sephardic Jews is how they're referred. But so many were pushed out in the 15th century. Where did they end up going?
The largest group seems to have traversed the Mediterranean and settled in what was then the world of the Ottoman Empire. And they established very important communities in what is now Greece and Turkey, Bulgaria, Syria, Israel, Palestine. There were also those who jumped over the Strait of Gibraltar and settled again in another Muslim society, that of Morocco. And yet there were other Jews who lived for some generations as conversos. And upon the ramp up of the Inquisition in later years, both in Spain and in Portugal, some of those people of Jewish origin fled to Northern Europe, especially to places like Amsterdam and London, because of the Spanish and Portuguese and also Dutch colonies in the Americas that form. You have people of Jewish origin, conversos, among those who join the voyages to the Americas.
And they took with them this particular language, didn't they? Ladino, which I guess is what, a mixture of Hebrew and medieval Spanish, but a lot of that's been lost now, I think.
That's correct. So there are a variety of different languages that the Sephardic Jews and their descendants developed over the generations. And generally, the Ladino language refers to the specific variety of Castilian-based Jewish language that the Sephardic Jews developed, especially in the context of the Ottoman Empire. It sounds largely like the Spanish of Cervantes, if you will, but has a profound influence of the surrounding cultures and languages. So there's an influence not only from Turkish, but also Greek, Italian, French, Arabic, and because they were Jews, a very strong Hebrew component, and the language was written until the 20th century in Hebrew letters. I'll give you an example of a refrain, a proverb. It goes like this: Se levantan los pepinos y ajarvan a los bakshavanes. If you know Spanish, se levantan los pepinos, it means the cucumbers have risen up, okay? Y ajarvan a los bakshavanes. Harvar is a Hebrew origin word that is turned into a Spanish verb, and it means to hit or to beat. And bakshavan is a Turkish origin word, which means farmer. So the refrain means the cucumbers have risen up and they have beaten the farmers. And this is an expression one would use when a child talks back to a parent or a student to a teacher.
Well, I'm sure your students don't plan that, Professor.
No, that would never happen.
And that was Professor Devon E. Nahr speaking to us earlier. And as we were listening to that, some breaking news coming from police sources in California. And that is to say that a man with guns and a fake pass has been arrested outside Donald Trump's rally in Coachella in California. Details are still coming in, and we are expecting a news conference imminently from the Riverside County Sheriff's Department. The BBC will be across that, and there is a live page up already on this story. If you've just joined us, a man with guns and a fake pass has been arrested outside a Donald Trump rally in California. That news just breaking in the past few minutes. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Now, the murder of a former minister in the Indian state of Maharashtra has raised security concerns in the city of Mumbai. Baba Siddiqui was killed in a drive-by shooting on Saturday night. Police have made two arrests and are still on the hunt for a third suspect. As well as politics, Mr. Siddiqui was a well-known figure in the entertainment industry and apparently had recently received death threats. For more details, I've been speaking to the BBC's Mayuresh Kunnar.
The police are saying they are still doing a preliminary investigations. They have few leads and they are working on that. What we know so far is that Baba Siddiqui, who was a known politician and who also has very deep connections in the Bollywood film industry business in Mumbai, while he was getting out of his son's office, his son is also a politician and currently the member of Maharashtra Assembly. And while he was getting from the office and into his car, he was shot at by three gunmen. He was taken to a nearby hospital, but then he was declared dead in few minutes. And currently five police teams are being formed. Right now, what we have is two of the three gunmen have been arrested.
Okay. I mean, you say that there are theories going around. Mr. Siddiqui was a big figure in the city, and there is speculation that this could be a possible contract killing. What can you tell us about his background politically, first of all?
He was a long-time member of Indian National Congress, and he himself got elected to Maharashtra Assembly for three consecutive terms. He was a very well-known figure. As far as Congress and politics is concerned, he was a face of Mumbai Congress, Mumbai being the capital of Maharashtra and also the financial capital of India.
Okay, so he was a big figure in the Congress party, but then he joined the unrelated regional National Congress Party, the NCP, which actually is part of the current governing coalition, I think, with the BJP.
Yes, it is. So Baba Siddiqui ended his long-time association with the Congress and joined NCP to be a part of ruling dispensation. And there were talks that since Maharashtra is going into an assembly election in just a few days now, Siddiqui will again contest from his own constituency.
And Mayuresh, a quick word on the security concerns after this killing, because it all happened while the city was actually under quite tight security because there's been a big festival going on over the past few days.
Yes, it is. And that's the concern. You know, Baba Siddiqui reportedly got a death threat few days back, and that was reported to police by him, and he was given vice-grade security by the police. So now the question arises, if his security was beefed up, he had a vice security, still how the assailants reached him and breached the security and got him murdered. That's the main question.
The BBC's Mayoresh Connor there. Now, October is considered the spooky month for many around the world, ahead of Halloween, of course, on the 31st. Lots of people dress up then as ghosts and zombies, which are supposed to be human beings returning from the dead. Well, for decades, zombies have featured in many films. Some are supposed to terrify us, others are a bit more comical. But where did the idea of zombies come from? A new exhibition in Paris is looking at how the zombie myth extended around the world from Haiti, and it investigates a strong connection to the slave trade in Africa. Vincent Dowd has this report.
Welcome to a night of total terror.
The Quai Branly Museum in Paris looks at cultures worldwide. Its latest exhibition is all about zombies, partly about how we regard the walking undead today, influenced by films such as Night of the Living Dead, made in 1968 by George A. Romero.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
But the new exhibition also shows, using French and English, how the concept of the zombie moved first to Haiti from Africa and then into international popular culture. Curator Philippe Charlier.
Think about Hollywood zombies, book zombies. This is absolutely the fake one. The true one belongs to Haiti because you've got the conjunction of all the religions from sub-Saharan Africa. And second, you've got a slave territory. Only in Haiti you may find true and authentic zombies. The name zombie comes from Black Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa, especially from Democratic Republic of Congo. And zombie means ghost of a dead child. The concept moved during the slave trade because it was a spirit initially, but no corpse. Then, with a zombie in Haiti, it's a corpse without any spirit.
Cinema audiences may long have delighted in gory tales of the dead returning to life.
Not dead? Are you mad? I saw her die.
Zombie! Allez!
But the exhibition shows that zombies entered pop culture only after a horrific era in history. The trade in slaves found its focus in what is now Haiti. Roughly how many Black African slaves came to Haiti?
Oh, millions came to Haiti. We don't have yet scientific quantification of the number of slaves.
How much of what we're looking at in this exhibition in Paris has its origins in the slave trade?
Zombies in Haiti, so the original one, are a kind of new slave. Without this slave trauma, it would not have been possible to create zombies.
And over here in this display case, we have a number of... Well, explain to me what they are, Philippe.
These are iron shackles for slaves. Many of them have been found in Haiti.
Philippe Charlier says outside Haiti, there was little cultural interest in zombies until, in 1915...
Haiti was occupied by the United States of America, and anthropologists discovered the zombie phenomenon. And it was later discovered also by Hollywood. The two main goals of this exhibition, the discovery, full discovery of what a true zombie is, and also the real voodoo culture from Haiti, which is absolutely beautiful and exceptional.
The exhibition at the Quai Branly Museum is fun, but it also shows France thinking through little understood aspects of the Atlantic slave trade and its legacy.
Spooky stuff there from Vincent Dowd. Just before we go, some more details from the Californian police about that man arrested near a Trump rally in California. They're naming him as Vern Miller, 49. He was said to be illegally in possession of a shotgun, a loaded handgun and a high-capacity magazine. But it seems he was taken into custody without incident. And the authorities there are saying that the safety of former President Trump and attendees at the event was not impacted by his arrest. That latest just coming in now, and there'll be more in the news, which is up next. But from all of us here, thanks for joining us.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.